4. Of the monastery and of the best wine had in 7 years. They marched together for 2 days, and on the first day they saw no people and ate only green stems, a parsnip she pulled out of the ground, using the end of her dress wrapped around her hand, a grasshopper she managed to catch, and a very little honey. They were making for Paris, though the girl couldn't say why. Despite the devil's horns he had seen the night before, he thought about abandoning her no less than 12 times, and, to that end, he hardly responded to her attempts to speak to him. She had a pretty voice, and decent manners, and he would easily feel affection for her if he let himself, but he determined not to, with limited success.
"Where were you born?"
she said as they crested a hill under a pleasantly warm blue sky. "Picardy."
"What town?"
"A town."
"A big town?"
"Just a town."
"With what name?"
"Town."
"This town, is it near a mountain?"
"No."
"A hill, then?"
"No."
"A lake?"
"No."
"Farms?"
"No."
"All towns are near farms."
He scowled down at her, but she deflected this with a look of unperturbed precocity. The intelligence in her eyes goaded him, reminding him of someone else. Someone who had hurt him. "Then yes," he said.
"Near farms?"
"Yes."
"Good. Now we're getting somewhere. Trees? Is the town near trees?"
"I guess."
"I want to revisit the question of the hill, because you didn't seem sure."
"Yes, it was near a hill."
"But you seemed sure about the mountain, so no mountain."
"No."
"And the name?"
"Town," I said.
"No town is named town."
"Mine was. Townville saw Cunting Town. What did your papa do again?"
"He was a lawyer."
"It shows. Now shut up."
"You'll never get a wife being so mean."
"I already had one."
"What happened to her?"
"I killed her for talking." The girl giggled at that.
"And is she buried in Townville-sur Town?"
"Shut up."
"I suppose you killed your children, too."
"All of them."
"What were their names?"
"Boy, boy, girl. And shut up!" They saw the monastery on the second day, and only because they went into the woods to forage. They got less than a fistful of sour berries between them, but, as they were about to leave, Thomas spotted a hare and chased it down a footpath that led farther into the woods. The hare got away, of course, but the woods broke on a small hill, and from the hill he saw the low stone walls and the thatched roof, and what looked like a garden. "Oh, sweet Jesus, let our luck be in," he said, and the two of them went to the gate. It was a simple gate of interwoven sticks standing open. A wooden sign over the gate read, in burned-in Latin, "This gate opens to all who enter in Christ's peace." He drew his sword and went in. She followed behind him, with her hands clasped as if to pray, and then moved past him and headed directly for the little stone church, ignoring his, "Oh, wait!" He let her go, shaking his head at her, and then assessed the grounds. It was a small monastery, home to no more than 20 brothers from the look of it. Only the church and the outer walls were stone. The cloisters and dormitory were wattle and daub. Another hare, or the same one, darted from the garden, but Thomas didn't even try to lunge at it, instead making straight for the earthen cellar where he suspected the buttery would be. It had already been emptied. Considerately, respectfully, and quite thoroughly emptied. "No luck at all," he said, and suppressed the urge to spit. The dormitory was empty, except for 10 straw beds, several of which bore the stains of plague on them. He backed out quickly. He found the girl kneeling outside the church, praying silently into her clasped hands, her cheeks wet. "Why didn't you go in?" he said. She just looked at him and wiped her cheeks. And then he smelled them. He peeked in the door, waving flies away from his face, and saw 4 puffy corpses lying in the nave, wearing their off-white, undyed woolen habits. 3 were lying on their backs, and the last one, an old man, was curled like a baby near them. He had his eating knife in his hand, and his habit was open on one side. The floor was sticky under him. He had died trying to burst one of those awful lumps. Flowers were strewn on a lot of them. "Cistercians," Tomas said. Fresh dirt mounds out back covered the first brothers who fell, but only 4. If they had been buried, one to a grave, and if all the beds had been filled, a few were unaccounted for, probably those who had emptied the buttery. Maybe they thought they would go to another abbey. Tomas didn't envy them trying to travel unarmed with the last cart of food in the valley. When the girl finished her prayers, Tomas said, "No food. They got the stores and emptied the fish pond and the dovecote. They had an oven, but it's been cold a long while. The garden where they grew food is all turned up. All they've got is damned herbs and flowers." The girl went to the herb garden and motioned for Tomas to follow. She handed him a bucket from the well and walked him through the garden, filling it with flowers and greens she tore expertly with her small white hands. He started grabbing at everything, but she stopped him before he grabbed one green stem. She shook her head at him urgently. "What? Why?" She used her finger to write "monkshood" in the dirt. He furrowed his brow to read it, sounding out each letter. "Monkshood. Poison." "Oh, thank you. So, what, you're not talking?" "Not here." He sounded this out too, pointing at each letter. "What, because it's a monkery?" She nodded. "You didn't take a vow."
"Yes, I did," she wrote. "By the church, in my heart."
It was taking him so long to read this that she just pointed at the church and placed her hand over her chest. He grunted. "Is this vow for the rest of your life?" he asked. She shook her head. "Just while we're here?" She nodded. "In that case, we are definitely spending the night. Maybe a week." She reached into the bucket and threw some damp leaves at his face. One stuck on his forehead, and she laughed in spite of herself and her temporary status as maiden Cistercian. They ate their bucket of greens and bright flowers, along with the buttery little crowns of calendula, which he remembered now from his mother's garden. She used to mix it with chicken's grain to make their egg yolks darker, and, she said, better for the blood. Tomas kept picking out one broadish leaf, nodding his head as he tasted it. "What's this one?"
"Sorrel," she wrote.
He followed the letters with his finger, pronouncing each syllable as shakily as a foal walks. She nodded when he pieced them together correctly. "It's good, like a lemon, but good. And this?"
"Lovage."
"This?"
"Comfrey."
"This one I know. Don't eat it all, and get more of it in the morning if there is more. It's good to pack in a wound to stop bleeding."
"Yarrow."
"How do you know all this?"
"Mother,"
she wrote, and a smile broke so gently on her face that Tomas bit his tongue viciously to keep from weeping for his own. They slept in the open air of the cloisters, near statues of Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, Saint Genevieve of Paris, and the archangels Michael and Gabriel. Thomas woke up in the middle of the night and went to look at his comet. It was across Cygnus's neck now, and seemed to be reddish at the tip, as if there were a tiny vein of blood in it. He rubbed his eyes and looked away, but when he looked back, it was still there. He noticed a second comet now, close to it and very faint. "Just kill us all," he said. "What are you waiting for?" He slept hard after that, and dreamed of monks singing plain chant. He woke in the peach light that came just before sunrise. The air was chilly, and the girl was still sleeping. The air smelled of juniper, though he saw no juniper bush. It also smelled of wildflowers. Both of them had been covered in flowers. They met travellers the next day, a cloth merchant from Bruges, his family, and two Flemish men-at-arms, with 5 horses between them. All seemed to be in good health. Thomas would have been glad to meet them 2 months before, with Godfroy and his band of killers behind him. The horses were young, the cart promised excellent pickings, and Godfroy would not have raped this woman. The two parties stayed 50 paces apart, and Thomas and the merchant each shouted news about what lay behind him. The news was not good in either direction. Then the man offered to buy food. Thomas said he had none to spare, and would have said the same had the girl's sack been full of sausages and peas. Money wasn't what it used to be. The merchant looked at the sack. The older of the two Flamands suddenly looked nervous, and Thomas guessed that he was afraid the merchant might order them to search the sack. Neither man wanted to tangle with Thomas. The merchant, who was in fact assessing Thomas, finished this, saluted him, and moved his party on. The bridge Thomas wanted to cross was said to be just on the other side of a river town called Saint-Martin-le-Preux, but as he and the girl approached the town, they came to an overturned and wheelless handcart, on the bottom of which someone who was not a confident speller had painted, in what looked like blood, "Go back." As this was the only bridge they knew of, they continued forward. Although Thomas traded his straw hat for the helmet and carried the sword naked across his shoulders. The girl took her bird whistle out, poured a little of her water, and began to make birdsong with it.
"Stop that," he hissed.
"I just don't want to surprise anyone, and I thought this would let them know we're friendly."
"I'm not friendly."
"But I'm friendly, and I'm the one with the whistle."
He was just about to take it from her when a priest walked out to meet them, easily visible in his white linen alb, holding in his hand a horn lantern. It was still light enough to see, but the priest kept the lantern near his nose and mouth. He came from a hidden recess in the woods near which the skulls of animals had been nailed to trees.
"Stop, please,"
the priest said, holding up one very delicate-looking hand. Thomas was glad to keep his distance. He turned his head to left and right to make sure nobody was moving on their flanks. The priest now looked to the right and left as well, wondering if the soldier had Confederates skirting up the sides.
"You don't have to be afraid,"
the girl called out to the priest, but Thomas pinched her arm.
"Speak when I tell you to," he told her.
Then he called to the priest.
"We're not sick."
"Do you promise?"
he said.
"On my word," Thomas said. "Are you alone?"
"Oh, yes, quite alone."
The priest lowered his lantern.
"I'm not sick either."
"We saw your sign."
"Sign?"
"Go back."
Ah, that will have been the militia.
Where are they?
As I was their confessor, I fear they probably bypassed purgatory on their way straight to the cauldron.
Dead?
Some time ago.
We just want to cross the bridge.
That's problematic.
Why? There's no toll, is there?
There's no bridge. When was the last time you had wine? And I mean good wine.
Tomas smiled broadly, showing teeth in surprisingly good shape for his age. Teeth he would be very glad to stain purple. The people in the town near the river had burned the bridge to try to isolate themselves, but the death was on both sides and found them anyway. A peddler had paid a farmer to sleep in his barn, against the orders of the seigneur, but the next morning the farmer found him there with his face frozen in pain and fear, and muck from the horrid buboes staining the pits of his shirt. The farmer had 7 children, who worked and played in the fields with neighbor children and helped out at the widow's alehouse. Soon half the families on the east side of town were stricken, along with the widow. The die-off started, as it always did, with those who were good enough to minister to the sick and bury the dead, and with those who gathered at the alehouse, including the militia. When the churchyard was full, families dumped the bodies in the river and the eels fed on them. Then something else moved in that also liked to eat what the eels grew fat on. Fishermen who speared or cast nets for trout, eels, and pike began to disappear, even when they went in groups of 2 or 3. Nobody knew what was happening, until a young boy sprinted back to town and said that his father and uncle had been eaten by a great black fish or snake with a flat mouth that hid in the murky shallows. It had lashed at them with the end of its tail and pulled the men in, then tore them with spines, and then its great froggy mouth had opened and clamped down on their heads, swallowing each of them whole in several fast gulps. The boy had stood transfixed until he saw that it was slithering up the bank toward him, and then he had run screaming for the road. The monster would have caught him, but his panicked flight had startled his uncle's mule, still tied to its cart, causing it to buck and catch the thing's attention. It wanted the mule more than the boy, so it coiled all around the poor animal and bit its head off, dragging the body, cart and all, back down the bank and into the river.
"How long was it, boy?"
the priest had said.
"I don't know." "Think. You saw it take the mule, so of course it was longer than a mule. As long as 3 mules, perhaps?"
The boy shook his head.
"How many, then?"
The boy held up 8 fingers, then corrected it to 9. Several of the men in town who were still healthy and still brave enough to leave their houses met up at the alehouse and drank until they had the stomach to go down to the river and look for it. They took their axes and wooden flails, their clubs and scythes, and they swore to Saints Martin and Michael and Dennis to cleave the thing in 2 or die in the attempt. The priest, who drank with them, witnessed these oaths, and agreed to come with them, and to hold over the men his processional crozier with its agonized Christ. All their boozy courage left them when they went to the banks and saw the wreckage of the cart, and the piles of shit the thing had left on the bank, all full of boots and bones and broken tools, and even the shredded cuirass of a man at arms. Even with the bridge down, it seemed, some were trying to cross the river, but they were not making it to the far shore.
"This is beyond our power, brethren," said the priest. "God forgives us the oaths we make in ignorance. Let us return to town before we make the thing stronger on our fat and our blood."
None of them protested.
"What about the seigneur?"
asked Tomas, leaning toward the priest over his modest table.
"If he's well enough to issue orders about letting in strangers,
He should have enough spunk to buckle on his armor and put a sword in that thing. The priest smiled his distinctive, sad smile, making the well-used lines around his eyes deepen. He was probably a year or two older than Tomas, but drink and soft living made him look closer to 50 than 40. Faded speckles of wine on the chest of his alb, only muted by his attempts to clean them, testified to the death of the town laundress. Despite his woolly eyebrows and masculine chin, there was something womanish, almost wifely, about the cleric's aspect.
"Our lord is what you might call
a frightened cunt.
If no more generous term occurred to you, he has shut himself and his retinue in the tower. His herald comes down on Fridays and reads his proclamations, which are ignored. He never gets off his horse. A man confessed to me that he intends to throw a slop pot at the herald the next time he comes, and asked me to pardon him in advance. I told him that gesture would put him one slop pot closer to heaven. Better the herald should get a faceful of shit tomorrow than an axe handle across the nose next week. That's where things are heading. We starve down here, unable even to pull fish from the river now, while our master has the watermill and ovens and has hoarded back enough grain to keep himself fed until doomsday."
"So, a week's worth, then?" The priest laughed and went to pat Tomas's arm in fellowship, but Tomas pulled his mailed arm back with the sound of money being withdrawn from a card game. He waved a cautionary finger, but was still laughing, as was the priest. The priest noticed the salt stains on the knight's dark garments and the rust stains on his light ones. Had he had a page and squire? A wife? Or had he been this dirty before the death came?
"Who is the girl to you?"
asked the priest, gesturing where the girl lay sleeping on a straw pallet.
"And don't say your daughter."
"I don't know who she is, but she sleeps a lot."
"Maybe she's hoping to wake up from this bad dream."
"If so, she's smarter than both of us."
"I don't know what smart is anymore. More wine?"
"With pleasure."
"Good, isn't it?"
"The best. Black as a woman's heart and sweet as her—"
"Yes?"
the priest said, amused. "Other heart." The priest tipped the small cask of wine so the last of the pretty red liquid spattered out of it and into the serving jug.
"The wine is from Beaune, but it comes via Avignon, from the private stock of His Holiness."
"But how—"
"Where my younger brother is a steward, of sorts, one of those who dresses His Holiness, or was. His office now is less formal."
"But still—"
"My very handsome younger brother, 8 years my junior, but seems younger still. A certain cardinal is fond of masculine beauty, and this pope is known for his generosity. Even when it comes to vices, he does not share."
"Ah."
"Indeed."
Tomas laughed. "So you drink the fruit of your brother's damnation?"
"Just the one barrel. I believe God has it within his heart to overlook my overlooking."
"You had only one barrel of this. Why drain it tonight?"
"Why not? The desire came on me suddenly. It's the last wine in town. I should have used it up at Mass, but there is neither wafer nor bread to go with it. I think the monks who made my wafer are all dead."
"Cistercians? Half a day from here?"
"Yes,"
the priest said hopefully. "They're dead. A few may have fled."
"Ah,"
the priest said. His Adam's apple bobbed as he swallowed hard twice, and his eyes moistened. He nodded. He looked as if he wanted to reach out for Tomas's hand, but he didn't.
"Anyway, nobody comes now. I haven't even been in the church in 2 weeks. I'm as scared to go there as they are."
If you don't go to church, how do you know they don't go looking for you? The priest looked down at his hands, where the fingers were grabbing each other.
They know where I live. Some still come for confession. They shout their sins from the path, and I shout back their penance from my window. Though even that's been nearly a week. No more mass, in any event. And the wine may serve a holier purpose in your belly.
Oh?
I was hoping a cup or two might extract some knightly oath from you. You are a knight, or were.
I was. I still am, I suppose. But it feels more like I was. It feels like a long time ago.
You could be one again.
I doubt it. I have done things.
Things?
I was cheated of my holdings.
The English?
Tomas shook his head.
Worse, a Norman. Le Comte d'Evreux, who treated with the English after our loss at Crecy. My keep was near Givrat. I despaired of justice. I took to the road and lived by the strength of my arm. I sought out even worse men than myself. I wanted revenge on him. I still do. Tomas fell silent.
Do you want to make confession?
No.
Not to me, eh?
I just don't want to.
I wouldn't blame you if it was me.
No, it's... No, there's no point.
Kill the abomination in the river, and God will make you a knight again.
I'd rather he got me another goblet of this.
No, the priest said. You wouldn't rather a goblet of wine than your honour back. Your joking is pleasant, but it doesn't hide the hole in you.
Tomas turned his eyes away from the priest's warm gaze. He only just managed not to cry. He did this by angering himself at God for making him suffer and pay for sins he had been backed into. God ringed you round with hounds and cornered you, then speared you with your back against a tree. When Tomas spoke, he turned down the corners of his mouth, and his words came out as a quiet growl.
I'll kill the whoring thing.
5. Of the Thing in the Murk. Tomas slept poorly. The wine had given him a burning stomach, and when he slept, he dreamed of wading in mucky water, looking for things he had dropped. He gave up at first light, still belching sour wine, and began to put his armor on.
Christ, it tasted good going in.
He had slept in his filthy padded leather gambeson, as he had for months now. So he started right in, putting on his armor, starting with his cuisses. He had finished buckling his second thigh piece when he stopped. The priest was sleeping heavily on his short bed, with his knees drawn up and his ankles crossed. Tomas shook him awake. The smaller man looked frightened at first to see the large, strong shadow over him. But then he remembered he had a guest.
Good morning,
the priest said. How deep is the river?
The river?
Where your monster is. How deep? Thighs? Tits? Chin?
Well, chin, on me, at the deepest, perhaps to your shoulders.
Shit, Tomas said.
You're really going to the river, then?
I said I would.
What we say and what we do are...
Well, I do what I say, which is why I don't say much. Tomas stood for a moment, considering the heavy, rusty mail coat in his hands.
You're wondering about your armor?
Yes.
You only half believe there's a monster in the river, and you don't want to drown looking for it.
I know of men who have been pulled under by their armor. That's real. The thing you described? I don't know. It seemed possible last night that a monster might be eating men in your river, though I've never in my life seen a monster. So this morning, can such a thing exist in sunlight? Yet it seems these are the end days. I think hell has opened its doors.
I think that too.
Spines, the boy said.
Spines.
Tomas considered the priest's soft hands and kind, almost comical face, what with his wild grey eyebrows and long head. He didn't seem sick, though he was likely a bugger. Not that Tomas had known many of the latter. Help me with the rest of this. The priest stood and helped Tomas wriggle into his mail shirt and buckle on his shoulder pieces.
You should scour all that,
the priest said, smiling and showing Tomas his orange hands. Later, if your big eel eats me and shits me by the river, it should have rust for its spice.
What, saffron? It's nearly that color.
Who can afford saffron? Mix it with blood, and we'll have paprika. The priest laughed. Tomas put his surcoat on over everything. It was filthy and blue and had no coat of arms on it.
Now get me your sword. You'll want me to bless that.
Where is my sword? He had propped it against the wall, but now it was gone. As was the girl. Tomas banged the door open and went outside, where the sun was now rising, peering tentatively under a scud of clouds that would soon swallow it. He saw the girl sitting by a tree with his sword unsheathed next to her. She had blood on her gown. He stomped over to her, took the sword up with one hand, and yanked her up by the arm with the other.
Jesus whoring Christ!
He said, looking at the cut on the meat of her hand. It was half the length of her smallest finger, and not very deep, but it was still bleeding.
Do I have to watch you every second? Can't I just sleep without you doing something stupid?
I'm sorry,
she said meekly.
What was your idea, touching my sword? Nobody touches my sword but me.
I wanted to clean it for you.
Well, don't! This is what you get!
He bent her arm around hurtfully to show her dripping hand to her.
I want to help.
You bleeding all over my things doesn't help me, you or anybody. Understand?
She nodded, trying not to cry, and he noticed he was still holding her wrist, which suddenly looked very small and fragile in his big hand. He let it go. She wanted to rub it, but she was embarrassed and hid it behind her instead, looking up at him. He was about to bark, "What do you want now?" at her. But he thought about it and saw that she was hoping to get some kind word from him. He fished around in his head for one.
Go see the priest,
he said, as gently as he could.
He may have a cloth to bind that little cut, and put some yarrow in it, since you know what that is.
She obeyed him. He picked up his sword and saw that her blood was smeared on its point and the well-notched edge that had bitten her.
Clumsy little witch, he said.
It got darker. A drop of rain fell in Tomas's eye. The priest went with Tomas, wearing his chasuble and a threadbare golden stole, holding the crozier over his head while the girl walked beside them, swinging a censer with frankincense and rosemary in it. At the priest's suggestion, Tomas held his sword by the blade, inverted so the quillons made a cross of it. The rain was light now, little more than a mist, but the road was muddy enough to coat the soldier's boots and the priest's simple shoes. The girl had left her shoes behind because she felt God-liked bare feet better than shoes for holy work. Two men from town came with them, one a heavily bearded young man with an ancient boar spear, The other, a fat, blonde farmer, with blonde porcine bristles on his jowls, armed with a billhook for hedges. Both wore straw hats. The smaller one looked scared, as did the priest. They had both been to the river to see the thing's signs, but not the farmer. The farmer was piss drunk. Tomas reminded himself to stay well away from him if a fight started, because he was stout and thick-armed and likely to gut friend and foe alike. Among the bitterer lessons of brigandage, Tomas had learned, was that farmers were strong, often stronger than the horsemen who despised them, and that they lived so close to starvation that they would fight like bears to hold on to what crumbs and bits of wood or leather they owned. If the priest hoped their procession would draw fresh recruits from the houses they passed, he was disappointed. A few women peered at them from windows, all crossing themselves, and, on the outskirts of town, one bare-ribbed dog looked up at them briefly before going back to breakfast on the foot of a corpse leaned up against a sheep wall. The body had a flour sack over its head at least, but it had stained the sack, and it stank even in the cool rain. Sheep's bones littered the field past the wall. Sheep had fared as poorly as men in this scourge, and the seigneur's keep came into view around a stand of alder trees. The pilgrims marched up to the gate, where Tomas pulled a leather cord that rang a bell up on the battlements. He waited the time it took the swaying, fat farmer to piss against the wall. The priest admonished him with his name, Sanson, but was waved away with the man's free hand. And then Tomas rang the bell again. After a third tug on the cord, a very pale young man with plucked and redrawn eyebrows looked down at them from the wall. He held a crimson woolen cloak squared over his head, presumably to protect fine clothes they couldn't see from their angle.
"If you're not here to buy grain, then go your ways," he said. "Good herald," the priest said. "Please let us speak to Guillaume." "Guillaume has fallen. I am seneschal now. You may speak to me." "Then I will say a mass for Guillaume, and rejoice in your good fortune. We have not come here to buy grain, which you know we cannot afford, or to rent your mill, for we have nothing to grind, or your oven, for we have nothing to bake. Rather, we offer your master the chance to win God's love in battle." "Go away," he said simply, and disappeared.
Tomas felt his anger rise.
"Herald!"
he shouted, making the skinny man flinch. No answer came from above.
"Whoreson ass-sniffing herald!"
The herald reappeared.
"Who has the insolence to speak that way to me? When you speak to me, you speak directly to my lord."
"Then tell your lord to get his little prick out of his wife and help us kill the thing in the river."
"You common bastard,"
the herald yelled.
"I'll have you know we still have men-at-arms in here."
"Then tell them to stop husbanding their hands and come down to the river. Something is killing your people."
"It's called the plague, you idiot,"
the herald said, more quietly, and disappeared again. Tomas's worst insults didn't bring him back this time, so he grabbed the cord and yanked with all his might, grinning at the sound of the bell coming loose and clanging down stone steps somewhere above them. The five of them gasped at what they saw. Tracks in the muddy bank, like a snake would make, but much larger, had beaten under all the grass close to the river and crisscrossed and looped between here and the town. It was visiting the town now. The piles of foul shit the priest had described were still there, full of bones and clothes. A woman's severed leg lay white but mud-spattered just by the bank. This was nothing less than a visitation from hell. The priest, quite pale now, began to pray psalms in Latin, and he urged the girl to swing the censer, which she did. The man with the big beard started shaking. Tomas said quietly, "Priest, if it goes badly for us, run like a young man and take the girl. She'll try to stay, but don't let her." The priest never stopped praying, but nodded, which Tomas didn't see because he kept his eyes fixed on the milky grey waters of the river. He went forward at a crouch, with his sword at the ready. The stout, drunk one with the billhook came next, and the beardy one barely walked forward at all, staying close to the priest and the girl. Tomas was as taut as wire. Step. 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 He froze when something moved in the water near the pilings of the collapsed bridge, something like an oily black arm, but the width of a draft horse's chest. He wasn't entirely sure he had seen it. Then all of them said some variant of, "My God," when its head broke the water's surface. White-eyed and flat-headed, like some giant cross between eel, newt, and frog, it laid its head on the bank and felt the ground with long whiskers around its mouth and eyes until it found the woman's leg. Its tongue darted out and latched onto the leg with a thatch of evil little hooks at its tip, pulling it under the water with it, bending a growth of sweet flag rushes. They sprang back up. The water foamed and then flowed gently again, as if none of it had happened. Those white eyes. A grandfather's blind eyes. The small beardy man dropped his boar spear and ran so fast his hat blew off him. The stout one stood open-mouthed, then vomited. But he didn't run. Rather, he followed Tomas right up to the edge of the water, which flowed gently now and showed no sign of the thing. "Please, sir, knight, please protect me in this fray." "Wipe your chin," Tomas said. "Now what?" He was so heavily armored he dared not go far into the water, but when his slapping the water with the flat of his blade and his shouts of, "Ho, ho there, bring your black ass out of the water and fight me," failed to rouse it, he ventured first one leg and then the other into the softly flowing murk. The big farmer stood near him, wide-eyed, shocked sober, his arms so tense the end of the billhook quivered. "Hand me that boar spear," Tomas said. The farmer did as he was told, fetching and handing over the wickedly pointed spear. Tomas put his sword in his left hand and began to use the spear to probe the water in front of him. He jabbed at it viciously, hoping to goad the thing into surfacing. It didn't. Tomas went a little farther in. He looked at the burned pilings, wondering if it nested down there, curling itself around them. Perhaps he should wade over there. He could use them to help him keep his head above water. The wind blew harder, and the rain came now, threatening to snuff the girl's censer, which she still swung dutifully. The priest's Latin prayers were harder to hear. Tomas alternated between stabbing the water with the spear and slapping it with the sword's flat, until it seemed to him that he was wasting his time. "What? You only kill mules and fishermen? You only take the legs off fishwives? Come and get me! Me!" he said, his voice cracking a little. Rain poured into his armor and down his face, making him blink. Relief that the thing didn't want to fight him blended with shame at that relief, but then relief won out. Perhaps a few more stabs at the base of the pilings, and then he could say he'd done his best. He slapped the surface of the river half-heartedly again, then began backing out of the mucky water, and tripped. He put his booted heel down on a submerged log in the mud behind him. The log slithered out from under his foot at great speed, causing him to fall into the river and hurl the sword behind him. He thrashed in the water and sputtered, getting to one knee with difficulty, cocking his spear arm. Part of the thing coiled through the water in front of him. He lunged at it with the spear, twisting his body into it with the brutality that hours in the tilt-yard had made as natural for him as walking. The spear stuck deep. That lunge would have impaled one man and killed the man behind him, but this was no man. The thing coiled rapidly away from him, wrenching the spear from his grip. He stood up with great effort, the sodden chainmail trying to drag him under, and launched himself toward where the sword had fallen. He saw that the girl was looking for it too, up to her thighs in dirty water, her little limbs white against the river and darker sky. She bent down fully into the water now, her face submerged as though she were hunting turtles. He tried to yell, "Get back!" at her, but could only cough. So he reached into the water, grabbed a fistful of her blonde hair, and jerked her up and toward the bank. She had the sword by the blade, getting cut again as she fell and dropped it. He saw where it fell, though, and saw her clambering through the mud and up to the bank. The priest was running to fetch her. Tomas grabbed the sword and wheeled around to the river, sensing he had had his back to it for far too long a fall of seconds.
"Watch! Watch!"
the priest was yelling over the rain. He turned to see the thing slithering toward him just under the water, its flat, froggy head as big as two tournament shields, its obscene whiskers trailing behind it, the spear making an S pattern in the water where it was still stuck in the thick of it. It was easily 20 paces long, the water rolling over it, hypnotic, almost beautiful. Its head broke the surface now, and its whiskers flicked forward and whipped him. Tomas heard splashing to his right, but ignored that, keeping his eye on the monster and bringing his sword up. It opened its mouth wider than it should have been able to, showing its sickly white inside and rows of teeth the length of long fingers. Thick, clear liquid poured from it. It coiled its body up behind its open mouth in preparation for the strike, as Tomas readied himself to die, plunging his sword down its throat. Something flashed at the edge of Tomas's vision, and he saw the billhook come down with great force on the side of the thing's head, opening up a white, blubbery wound and making it hiss. The billhook fell again and again. The farmer was going at it like he was hacking down a tree, his red mouth pursed with the effort. Tomas struck it with his sword now, cleaving a horrible wound into its nose and mouth, from which it recoiled, doubling back on itself under the water with a great splash. Once it was out of reach, it broke the surface again, rearing up to show its white belly, on which pairs of backward-facing, curved black spines the size of paring knives were arrayed like teats. It hissed at them, and the spines flexed and oozed black fluid all over its belly. It had oily fins on the sides of its neck, ending in more spines. Now its tail rose up out of the water, and the farmer crossed himself and whimpered. The tail had a human hand at the end of it, so white it was nearly translucent, bright against the black sky. A fucking hand! The tail slithered forward now, and the hand groped the side of the thing until it found the spear stuck in it, which it pulled out. Thunder grumbled behind it. The farmer started whimpering an Ave Maria, and it cocked its head, listening, its whiskers whipping excitedly. Tomas banged his fist heavily on the stout man's shoulder to shut him up, but he only prayed louder. Without warning, a ripple went through the thing, and the end of its tail lashed like the end of a whip. The hand released the boar spear, and it flew at the farmer as though it had been shot from an arbalest. It would have skewered him right through his praying mouth had not Tomas shoved him. As it was, it laid open his cheek and his temple, and he screamed horribly. Then the creature did the worst thing Tomas had seen yet. It opened its mouth and exactly imitated the farmer's scream. It moved toward the men again, The farmer just kept screaming, even as it mocked him, holding his hand against his head where the blood ran out thin and fast in the rain. Tomas had never been so afraid. "I can't, I can't, I can't," he thought, even as he drove his legs forward through the muck to meet it. Tomas swung hard at its head, but he only hit it a glancing blow as it lunged past him and grabbed the screaming farmer, cutting off his screams as it took the man's head and shoulders into its mouth with a violent, wet, slapping sound. It contracted the muscles in its neck now, and lifted the heavy farmer out of the water, pointing his kicking feet at the sky and trying to swallow him in repeated gulps. Bamf! 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 Like a pelican taking a big fish. Tomas saw the end of the farmer's billhook sticking out of the water. He sheathed his sword so not to lose it, then sloshed over to grab the polearm. The thing was having trouble getting the farmer down. Tomas slashed at it with all his considerable strength, gouging tears in it that would have gutted an ox. One of these, driven high, opened a hole near the lump the thing was trying to swallow, and Tomas was treated to the sight of the farmer's white face turning as he went farther into its gullet. It could no longer ignore the strong man tearing at it, though, so it turned its blind face toward him, the other man's feet sticking out of its mouth. It lashed its whiskers at Tomas to find him, then slithered the tail hand up around his leg. It dropped its head and neck into the water now, and slithered more of its coils around the nuisance who had been chopping at it. It foamed the water with its spasms as it continued trying to swallow its meal, but now its back half was free to fight. Tomas dug at it underwater with the point of his weapon, gouging it so its oily blood floated up. But then the awful white hand was on his face, grabbing his cheek excruciatingly, digging for his eyes. He wrenched his head back and forth, then drove the weapon into the riverbed so he could find the shaft again. He was not strong enough to pull the hand away from his face, however, and he felt something sharp scrape his cuisse as the thing constricted around his leg.
"Whoring spines!"
he squealed crazily, standing wide and struggling to keep his footing, now jerking the hand's thumb back as he would to break a man's grip. With the other hand, he found the knife on his belt and began to saw where the hand joined the tail. His knife bit deep, and it withdrew the hand to save it, then jerked, pulling Tomas underwater. He felt sure he would die now, but he didn't give up. He wrestled and arched and managed to get half his sword free, though it was no easy task with the black coils around his legs and those evil spines scraping his chainmail. And he bent into a coil of it and started using his weight behind the half-exposed blade to cut. It thrashed, jerking him around madly on the muddy bottom, though his head broke the water and he managed to get a breath in him. His sword came out of its scabbard, and he held onto it for his life. It was then that one of the spines on the bottom of it found purchase and punched through his armor at the groin, where a few snapped links of chain he had meant to have mended allowed a small opening. It was enough. He ground his teeth together against the pain and nearly lost the last of his air, but instead drove his sword into it hard, causing it to release him entirely. He broke the surface of the water and got heavily to his feet just as the thing's head came up, its first meal now down nearer the middle of it, but it was Tomas who moved first, lunging at its neck. He got there before it could face him and leaned into his sword, driving it through the monster and driving the monster down until he felt his point bite rock on the other side. He pulled the sword half out and changed the angle, leaning into it again and using the strength of his legs against the river bottom to push like a ploughman and slit a huge gash in it, through which black, stinking fluid now poured. It thrashed violently, but Tomas held on even though the world was beginning to get dark. He summoned what felt like the last of his strength and pushed the sword toward where he hoped a heart was. It punched through something. The thing shuddered and turned on him now and bit him, taking his head and neck into its mouth as it had done with the peasant. But, though the pressure on his chest was terrible, its strength was ebbing, and its teeth did not pierce his chain. Tomas screamed hoarsely in the darkness of its mouth, and then couldn't scream any more as it took him under water. Water and foul issue flooded its mouth, and Tomas began to black out. Then it shuddered again, and vomited Tomas into the river, along with the dead farmer, someone's head, the woman's leg, and any number of eels. Tomas fought to keep his head above water, praying the priest would haul him out. But he was alone and dying, with his armor heavy on him in the river. He would have to save himself. He heard it thrashing, and then the thrashing stopped. He thought it was dead, but didn't think he had the strength both to turn and look at it and to keep from falling into the water. He hauled himself to the shallow part and nearly collapsed, but he knew he would still drown if he did. So, with his leg going numb from the thing's spine in his groin, and the river and black sky seeming to spin around him as if he were a bead in a toy top, he crawled through the mud on his three good limbs until his face was far enough out of the water that he knew he would not breathe any in. His legs were still in the water. If it wasn't dead, it would drag him under. But he didn't care now. Something was banging on his armor and his helmet. Hail. It was hailing. So this is the end of the world, he thought, feeling nauseated, hoping to pass out. And he passed out. 6. Of the marriage on the bank and the visitation in the stable. The woman stumbled down the muddy road, trying to remember how to get to the river. She had lived in Saint-Martin-le-Preux her whole life, but the fever made her forgetful, and she kept losing her way. The hail had woken her up from what might have been her last sleep, and when she woke, she had such thirst that only the river could slake it. Besides, a devil was in her house. Not the devil himself, but a small one. A goat kid with a twitching tail that climbed on the bed with her and tried to steal her breath when she got sleepy. It leapt away when she woke and hid in the shadows, waiting for her to get sleepy again. She would cheat it this time. She knew it wouldn't follow her to the river. She went out into the hail and took a beating from it, but it stopped soon and turned to cold, stinging rain. She got terribly lost, even though she knew the river was close, and she slapped her palm on several doors. Some of them doors she recognized as belonging to friends, but nobody opened to her. She cried against the wall at one house, and a gentle voice from inside, her sister's voice, said,
"Go on now, Mathilde. I still have the 2 children, and you mustn't give it to them. Go on."
So on she went. Her children had died of it, and her sweet old husband and his brother, and she was the last one in the house. She had paid a young boy to care for her when she knew she had it, but he had left after one day. All he did was bring her things she asked for, but he refused to empty her slop jar, and still he wanted a week's farm wages for the first day. She paid him, but he saw where she got the money from and took the coffer in the night, leaving her with nothing. The boy had worked with her husband, learning to be a cobbler. Now he had his master's money, but little good it would do him in hell. He was already sweating with the first fevers. It was after he left that the little goat had come. The woman had no wimple on, and her pale orange hair hung greasily about her shoulders. Her eyes were red and swollen. Windows closed as she passed them, and it began to make her angry. She wanted to stop and have words with the betrayers who were abandoning her, but her throat hurt like it had pins in it, and if it came to a fray, she didn't want anyone touching her left armpit, which had grown a painful swelling the size of a crab apple that gurgled at night and seemed to speak to her. She had to get to the river. At length, she remembered a turn between two houses that she had passed several times, and she stumbled downhill, laughing and crying at the same time at the sight of the water. She didn't care if the water was clean, as long as it was cold. She would wade into it, and might even put her head under to stop the heat in it. That was when she saw the knight, lying on his stomach with his feet in the river. She knelt next to him and drank, coughing half of it back up. Something foul was in it, foul and oily, but her throat felt better. She looked at the knight and saw that he was strong and beautiful and dead. She cried for how beautiful he was. Even his scars were beautiful and perfect, the pit on his cheek where God had put his finger to mark him as holy. She lay down next to him on her side and took off his helmet. He still wore a chain hood, but she could see his hard, beautiful face better now. Her husband's wedding ring was on a cord around her neck, and she took this off and breathed on it and pushed it onto the knight's finger, though it wouldn't pass the second knuckle because his were soldier's hands.
"I marry you," she said. "I marry you now, knight."
She cried and kissed his still mouth, tenderly at first, then with her tongue. His mouth was warm. He was breathing. She became confused about whether he was dead. Perhaps not, but, like her, he would be soon. Everyone would be soon. She used her hair to clean his brow, and she stroked his face with her hand.
"My husband is in heaven with his first wife, but I will go to heaven too, and you will be my husband there, and I will be a good wife. I will show you. I will dress for bed," she said,
and took off her sickness-stained gown and one of her muddy hose. She got tired unrolling the second one, and draped herself across the knight's armored back, and died there. And that was how the priest found the armored man and the pale, dead woman, nude but for one stocking, her back covered in plague tokens the color of eggplant, as if a little goat had danced upon her and bruised her with its hooves.
"Where am I?"
Tomas shouted from the bed, his eyes wild.
"You're in my home," the priest said, looking down at him. "You've been hurt."
The priest was holding a lantern near his nose and mouth. It was night. Tomas began to remember. The creatures in his dream had not been friendly, so he took a moment trying to remember if this priest was. Frogs. Now he remembered. Frogs had come, latching onto him, feeding on him, covering his face and hands. He had been watching from outside himself as spiny little frogs ate him. He shuddered, then kept shuddering. The pains in his head and in the corner of his groin were distinct. One was leaden and dull, like an old rusty lock set at the top of his neck and embraced his temples. The other was hot, like someone had taken a coal from a brazier and tucked it at the top of his pubis. Everything on him felt clammy and sticky. He sneezed. He looked up at the priest again and saw the half of his face that was brightly lit by the lantern he held close to it. Three superficial scratches jagged across his cheek.
"What have you done with her?"
Tomas said, and sat up heavily, looking at the priest with dangerous, murky eyes.
"Nothing, friend. She's... oh, the scratches. She gave me those when I pulled her away from you, on the shore. Really, I was pulling her away from the... There was a young wife, Mathilde, a good woman. With Christ now, if any of us are. You may be sick."
"Where is the girl?"
I persuaded her to sleep in the stables tonight, but she will come back when she wakes up. She sat on that little stool near you until an hour ago. She's quite faithful."
Tomas looked under the threadbare sheet that covered him and saw what the thing in the river had done to him. An awful hole a few inches above the base of his verge wept into the hair there. All the skin around it was swollen, and a separate swelling was coming in near it, where the leg met the groin. The whole area was a misery.
"So I have some uncleanness in me from that thing, as well as plague?"
"It seems so."
"Did you give me last rites?"
3 hours ago."
"I'll try not to sin."
"You're in no condition to sin, except perhaps unclean thoughts."
"Not having any hurts too much down there."
"You're safe from lust, at least. Having any temptations about gluttony?"
Tomas shook his head.
"And it's hardly sloth for a sick man to rest. Don't worry, I'll look after your soul. As for the body, that's in God's hands."
Tomas nodded.
"You killed it, you know."
Tomas made a pleased sound, and his lids got heavy.
"It floated downriver like an old empty sock, leaving its awful guts behind it. It was an awful, murderous thing, and you killed it with your own hand. It was worthy of a saint."
Tomas slept. He woke up again just before dawn to the sound of labored breathing. Not his own. Someone was suffering, trying to breathe with pierced lungs. He hadn't heard that sound since the catastrophe at Crecy, when he lay with a broken leg and an arrow through his face, listening to his seigneur breathe his last breaths, sucking bloody air in around the ashwood arrows that had punched through his chain hauberk in 3 places. He always loved his lord for not moaning, as other men did, as Tomas did. He knew in his heart that his lord, the Comte de Givrat, had died awake, gritting his teeth, using his last strength to keep from making an unchivalrous noise. The Comte was not as strong in the arms as Tomas. Almost nobody was. But he was tougher. He died a better death than Tomas was about to, fouling his 6 sheets in bed. But now, that horrible breathing. Outside his window, a shadow passed. He got to his feet and found that the right leg was completely numb, as if it had fallen asleep, and it was all he could do not to crash to the floor. He was sick and dizzy, and his nose was running into his beard, but he got his sword and moved past the sleeping priest. He opened the door in time to see the form of a man limping toward the stables, where the girl was.
"You!"
he said, but coughed at the end of it. The figure didn't turn. Tomas tried to run at it, but now his woodish leg betrayed him and tumbled him onto the ground, where he blacked out. He came to not very long after, and went farther toward the stables, where he saw the girl and the figure talking over a lantern. His eyes were tearing, and he couldn't see well, but it looked like a man, a shirtless man with long spines. Tomas lurched toward the couple, but the world spun again, and he went out. He woke again moments later, or thought he did, to find the spined man helping him into bed. Except the man was bleeding all over the bed and laboring to breathe, because he was full of arrows, not spines.
"Señor!"
Tomas tried to say, but it wasn't his lord. He didn't recognize the man. A short, dark-haired youth with protuberant, drilling eyes that looked almost luminous. The man exhaled a shuddering breath, spraying a small amount of froth from his chest wounds, then pressed hard with his thumb on Tomas's forehead, forcing him to fully recline. It hurt. The man wheezed and coughed horribly and limped out of the room. Tomas still felt the imprint of that hard thumb. He slept. But not before he muttered,
Sebastian, Saint Sebastian, help me.